Welcome to another episode of Urban Futures Unveiled. I'm your host,
Marissa
June, and today we are diving into an intersection of topics that have shaped the social and physical landscapes of our cities, environment and energy justice, and their connections to redlining. How do historic injustices continue to influence our energy systems and environmental health? Let's explore together.
So to understand where we are today, we have to go back in time. Redlining, a discriminatory practice that started in the 1930s, systematically denied communities of color access to mortgages and other financial services. Its effects go beyond housing. They've shaped environmental risks and energy infrastructure too. So today we'll be asking questions to unpack this issue and explore its implications for energy justice and equitable solutions. So let's start with the basics.
First, let's set the stage. What is energy justice and how does it connect to environmental justice? And here's a quick definition. Energy justice ensures that everyone, regardless of race or income, has access to affordable, sustainable, and clean energy. And similarly, environmental justice focuses on fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people in environmental policies.
So redlining exacerbated disparities by concentrating marginalized groups in areas with poor infrastructure and higher pollution. So how do these histories intersect? That leads us to the overarching question. How do historic redlining policies affect modern energy access and environmental risks?
And now we are excited to welcome today's guest, Dr. Ki-jin Song, an expert in urban planning and environmental policy from UT Austin. Dr. Song's research focuses on the intersection of equity, sustainability, and urban technology, making her the perfect person to help us unpack these complex issues. Hello, Dr. Song. Nice to meet you. I'm June.
I'm Marissa.
How are you doing today?
Great.
Thank you for joining us. So Dr. Song, can you tell us, our listeners, a little about your background and what inspired you or work in environmental planning?
Yeah, thank you for having me today. I'm Ki-jin Song, and I'm a postdoc researcher in the Urban Information Lab at the School of Architecture here at UT Austin. My work focuses on environmental justice, climate resilience, and public health.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, we are a big fan of your works. And let's dive into the heart of our topic. Studies show that formerly, right now, redlined areas often have fewer trees, more heat islands, and less access to renewable energy options like solar panels. Could you explain to the listeners what redlining is and provide some background on its history?
So redlining is a kind of some discriminatory planning practice that dates back to 1930s when the federal government, through the Homeowners Loan Corporation, so-called HOLC, created the maps to guide some mortgage lending. The neighborhoods were graded from A to D, with the A being most desirable and D outlined in red, deemed hazardous in investment. Unfortunately, these grades often had less to do with the actual conditions of the neighborhoods, but more to do with the racial and ethnic makeups of their residents. So the result was systematic disinvestment in predominantly African-American, immigrant, and lower-income neighborhoods.
So if we narrow down the scope, how does that affect environmental planning and policy issues like natural hazards, climate change mitigation efforts, extreme heat, or emergency responses?
The legacy of redlining really comes to life in several key aspects of environmental policies and planning. So East Austin, for example, is a part of the city that was historically redlined and experienced the decades of disinvestment. So because of that, the infrastructure, there is some older and often less resilient to natural hazard like flooding due to the aging stormwater systems that haven't been upgraded at the same pace as part of other part of the cities. And another issue is climate change and mitigation. So East Austin has fewer trees and more pavement, which makes it a hotspot for the urban heat island effect.
It's also important to note that residents in these neighborhoods are more likely to face health and mental struggles in addition to environmental. This is because they're exposed to more environmental stress on a daily basis. Let's hear more from June and Dr. Song on these issues.
As you mentioned, the critical angle seems to be like how these issues actually overlap to one another. And for instance, areas, as you mentioned, facing the greatest environmental risk due to historic redlining often have outdated energy infrastructures or resources. So how do you see energy justice evolving as a part of the larger environmental justice movement?
At its core, I think the energy justice is about ensuring that everyone, regardless of the income or background, has access to affordable, clean, and reliable energy. In many historically marginalized communities, like those that were redlined, people are paying disproportionately high energy bills while also having limited access to energy-efficient housing or renewable energy options.
Will there be any like challenges or opportunities in addressing these two pillars together?
Yeah, for sure. There are definitely both challenges and opportunities when it comes to tackling the energy justice and environmental justice together. So one of the big challenges is that a lot of these historically marginalized communities have been underfunded for so long. So when you start talking about adding some solar panels or making some homes more energy efficient, it's not always straightforward.
So it sounds like there's issues of mistrust going on. Dr. Song, could you give us some examples that actually demonstrate and make the real progress?
So the Solar for All project in Washington, D.C. helps the lower-income households get solar panels and reduce their energy bills. It's a way to make sure the clean energy isn't just for those who can afford the upfront cost, but also for the communities that have been left behind.
So looking ahead, energy and environmental justice will undoubtedly be shaped by political will. It's important to understand how federal leadership influences these energy justice policies. We can think of this through funding opportunities and setting the energy standards, or ensuring equity is at the core of clean energy initiatives. So how can local communities prepare themselves to push for equitable solutions regardless of the federal policy shifts that we'll be anticipating starting in January?
So data can be the powerful tool when you're trying to make a case for why something needs to change. So if you have a concrete numbers that shows how redlining has led to increased heat risk or higher pollution levels, then it's a lot harder for the decision makers to ignore. So it's about keeping up the pressure and building the local power and not waiting for the changes to come from the top down.
Thank you, Dr. Song, for sharing your expertise and shedding light on these critical issues. It's clear that addressing environmental and energy justice requires collaboration, innovation, and a commitment to equity.
Before we wrap up, here's something to think about. What do you do in your community to support equitable energy solutions? Whether it's advocating for solar programs, supporting grassroots environmental organizations, or simply staying informed, every action counts.
If you enjoyed today's discussion, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. Share this episode with a friend who's passionate about justice and sustainability.
Until next time, I'm Seungjun Choi.
Marissa Galati.
And this is Urban Futures Unveiled. Let's keep pushing for equity and innovation in our cities.